Moncrief on News Talk.
With the Dacia range. Drive away today with no payments for the first 3 months.
Joanna Fortune joins us once again. Afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Here's your first question. My daughter will be 4 in September and has always had some sensory issues. However, they seem to have escalated in the last few months. We can no longer get her to wear any shoes except wellies or runners with the Velcro strips fully open, resulting in them falling off when she walks. She refuses to wear any underwear, long sleeves, tops, coats, jumpers or trousers. We've tried numerous different types of clothes, underwear and shoes, but as soon as she tries them on, she gets hysterical. We've been fairly relaxed about it, but I feel like the shoe issue is affecting her ability to run now. And with the Irish weather, she can't live in short sleeve dresses. She's also afraid of loud noises such as hand dryers, etc. She does seem to have an unusually high pain threshold. I'm not sure if it's related, but she started toilet training a year ago and has never successfully been trained. She appears to have no sensation to pass water, and over the last year she's not once self-initiated going to the toilet to pee. If we don't toilet her every 2 hours, she would have 4 or 5 accidents a day and is always surprised when we tell her she's wet. She refuses to wear a nappy every night, so unless we sneak it on when she's sleeping, we have to change her bedding every morning. The GP has ruled out any urinary infections. The daily battles to toilet her and get her dressed are really starting to wear on us. She is otherwise a really happy and social little girl. Any help or suggestions would be really appreciated. My God.
Yeah, there's a lot there, isn't it? And there's certainly enough of a breadcrumb trail that I'd be kind of going, okay, I don't want to make an assumption these are all linked, but there is enough there to say that would make me want to say that she really needs to go back to the GP. So, and what I'd be saying around that, Sean, is that the GP... Okay.
You're not in McGowan's pub right now, by the way, are you? Because we heard a phone ringing.
Do you know what? I can hear something in one other room. One sec.
Your work is never done. Oh, she's been cut off. Okay, we'll have Joanna back on the line in just a couple of ticks. Now, if you were with us just a few moments ago, you'll know that Joanna was answering a question. I unfortunately opened my big trap to make a stupid joke and then everything fell apart. So that's what I get for being smart. Right, so we have this family with the 4-year-old. She has terrible sensory issues, which seem to be getting worse.
Yeah, so sorry about that. I don't know what happened. But what I was saying there was that at this stage, just because there's a number of things here that they went through, you know, the sensory issues, the unusually high pain threshold, you know, apparently a low sensation when she's ready to go to the toilet and needing a lot of prompting. I just think there's enough here that I'd be going back to the GP and seeking a referral to the developmental pediatric team in your area. So what that would involve is, because she's not quite 4, and because of COVID, you know, there has been a delay with the 3-year-old developmental checks. I'm wondering if she's had that yet. If she has, and the public health nurse has already passed her and discharged her from that service, it is definitely the GP who's going to make that referral for you. If not, it would be well worth contacting the public health nurse, making your public health nurse aware of these issues, these concerns that you have, and asking the public health nurse to expedite the developmental assessment as best they can, or to refer you to that developmental pediatric team. Because I just think that that's, for me, there's enough there that would warrant another closer look by a professional team who can do the whole spectrum together themselves. They can look at occupational therapy, they can look at developmental stuff and just see if a small change could make a big difference or if she needs additional support than that. In the meantime, at home, because these things take time and I think it can be really anxiety provoking and even frustrating for us parents when we're waiting for appointments like this to come up, certainly work on increasing her sensory play experience in general. It's developmentally appropriate, but actually for her, it might also build tolerance for things that she is currently intolerant of. So think about like shaving foam, just spray it onto a food tray, dry coloured rice, make your own Play-Doh, scent it, you know, really sand, water, bubbles, a lot of different textures to her play. I think that would be really useful, but not instead of the referral, it would be as well as.
My two boys are 3 and 5. To date, they have had their own room, but I've always wanted them to share. They don't get on great, and I'm hoping this might bring them together. They're very competitive for my husband and my attention. Everything is a fight for them. Who gets what toy? Who gets in the car first? Who's buckled in? Who gets this sweet or that drink? It's never ending. I'm hoping sharing a room will help them bond and find some common ground. Should I brace them for it or just do it? I know it'll start a fight. My thought process is, why have the fight for 5 days before it even happens? Any thoughts on how I might make a smooth transition? She has a point, all right.
She sure does, but a big part of me is going, why are you doing this? You know, what's the hurry with it? I was curious about, you know, that you've always wanted them to share a room. And what's that about? You know, what's your fantasy about? Did you share a room yourself as a sibling? Was it something that you really loved doing? And do you imagine that's what it's going to be like for your boys? Because all evidence points the other way at the moment. And I would be saying, not never share a room. I think that's very much a family and parental choice, but maybe build them up. I love this line, should I brace them for it or just do it? I'm like, no, don't do this, because if it's going to be a fight, then at least you know it's going to go terribly wrong and it's going to go badly and they won't want to share a room. Whereas if you put a little bit of time in now in a really kind of structured, focused way to building up a camaraderie between them, trying to refocus them on what they have in common instead of what they don't, then I think, look, 6 months down the road, then transition them into sharing a room. And that it should be a transition. It shouldn't be, surprise, guess where you're all sleeping tonight? Because the change of room should be happening with them, not to them. You know, they should get to bring their little duvet in and hang up some pictures and do their own little bits so that it's a part of them and they're a part of it. At this age, you know, 3 to 5 years old, they're kind of within developmental swing of each other. So they are quite naturally developmental competitors. But also at 3 and 5, they are in different developmental play stages. So your 3-year-old is coming out at that stage 1 sensory play to begin that stage 2 narrative play, whereas your 5-year-old is coming out of that stage 2 to go into stage 3. So they're not completely aligned. And I think that's where you're getting this conflict. They're very aware of each other, but they don't have a common ground to connect in and, you know, a moment of meeting that they can share. They're not into exactly the same things in the same way. So what I'm going to suggest is park the bedroom thing for a few months if you can, and instead focus on even a little every day and build it up and do a little more at the weekends if you've got extra time. But all of you play together as a family. So not just playing with one of the boys and then the other, but doing family-based activity play. And there are, you know, endless examples of how you can do that. But also using some challenge play with the two boys, but making it collaborative rather than competitive, so that you set them a task in the play that they have to work together to achieve. That could be you put, you know, a cotton ball or a ping pong ball or something, a foam ball, onto the ground, and they have to take turns blowing it to get it from starting point to end point, which is the other side of the room. So the 5-year-old takes the blow, then the 3-year-old does, the 5-year-old, the 3-year-old, and they get to the goal together rather than, you know, who gets there fastest, I'm the winner. So avoiding competitive play, but doing challenge that is collaborative, I think actually will scaffold up their relationship and enable this move to go a lot smoother. So a lot of that is what I'd be suggesting, family play and then setting the boys collaborative challenge play. But don't move them just yet.
Yeah, and even if you do move them into the room, aren't you just giving them one other thing to fight about?
Oh, at the moment, guaranteed. Absolutely. And the fact that you're like, I shouldn't give them notice because it's just going to be a longer fight. You know, they're not ready for this. And this is going to be. So if you have the capacity at home, and from what I'm reading here, you do, for them to have separate rooms for a little longer. But in your head as parents, you go, no, look, it's our plan that they will, as brothers, share a bedroom.
Yeah, Deborah says, I shared with my sister growing up and loved it. We would chat away at night. As we got older, we got closer. Yes, we fought, but I have more positive than negative memories. I made my girls share too, says Deborah. Might it be different for boys and girls?
No, I don't think there is a gender difference with this, but what it is about making sure that they're on board. I always think when you're introducing any change with a child, look, it's not that different with adults, to be honest, but with children, you want them to feel that they are a part of the change and it isn't just, well, you're sharing because I said so. But we don't want to. Tough, you're doing it. Because now you're also in battle with them. And the whole thing becomes conflict loaded. So it's going to be a much harder transition. I think build up the camaraderie, build up that collaboration piece, and it will all go easier. I still think if you want to do it, do it. But just plan it and plan towards it.
Right, we do have to take a break after that. A three-year-old who likes bold Paw Patrol. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Joanna Fortune is still with us, hopefully. There was a question that Joanna was dealing with there with the four-year-old with sensory issues. Someone's texting in to say, my daughter hates socks and shoes and much prefers being barefoot. We made a deal that she doesn't have to wear anything on her feet when at home, but when we leave the house, she has to. So far, she's happy with this deal. It's been a week, so fingers crossed it sticks. Would it be the case, is it not? Now, obviously the case that four-year-old sounded quite severe, but
yeah.
Do a lot of kids have kind of issues around sensory?
Absolutely.
Things?
And what that parent is describing is so familiar to me. And in and of itself, you know, not liking shoes and socks, but being able to tolerate wearing them is not something that I'd be going, gosh, I'm concerned. It's more when you've got the, you know, across the, you know, it's that shoes have to be open. I can't bear that strap across my foot. Lots of sensory clothing issues mixed with the other things that are listed. Then you begin to go, do you know what? That should be looked at. But lots of kids prefer to be barefoot than in shoes. And listen, any parent knows with a small child, as soon as you get the shoes and socks on them, you turn your back and they're sitting on the floor peeling them off.
Yes.
Because they just feel more comfortable running around like that. And it's a much more sensory grounding experience for them to be running around in with their bare little toes, feeling everything and taking it in. So I wouldn't worry about that at all. But it's when it's other stuff as well, I would.
I have a 3.5-year-old and a 5-month-old. My 3-year-old has never had any classic throw himself on the ground tantrums or slapped or kicked, nothing like that. She's a really lovely child. However, when she plays Small World with dolls and figurines, she loves to pretend the dolls are stealing and being bold in general. I think it might have started with Sweetie, the bold pup on Paw Patrol. She also requests all the time for me to read storybooks, but instead I have to make up a completely different narrative where the characters misbehave. Initially, I went along with it and saw it as harmless and funny, and I encouraged it even. Now that play school will start in September, I'm seeing things with different eyes. I'm afraid she will think that I have condoned it and it's okay to implement this fake bad behaviour into real life. So lately I pause the game and tell her that it's important to be kind, etc. She nearly rolls her eyes at me and says she's only playing a game, she's only pretending. Am I being a stick in the mud? Is it harmless to let our dollies be petty criminals, lol, and misbehave?
Oh, gosh, do you know what I think of this letter? I was just smiling as you were reading it there. I just think, you know what? The little one gets it. She gets it. They're way smarter than we give themselves credit for. And while children use their play to work out and process themes from the real world, they do know the difference between play and the real world. Mm. She knows that she's playing a game and it's not real. And I love that she can say, I'm pretending. What great mastery over imagination at such a young age. So I think this is really good. So when you pause the game, I'm going to ask you to stop doing that. You know, it's not your call to make. This is her play, her world. If you want to become more curious and more engaged in what she's playing and the themes emerging, insert yourself into the play. But you're going in there, she's the director, you're going to be directed. So you within the play could take on being a character. You could certainly offer a few alternative suggestions. Oh, maybe we won't do that, we'll do it this way. But if the director of the play says no, you'll do it the way you're told, follow her lead, because she is processing things here. I always think when it comes to play, we have to hold in mind that rules are a very important part of pretend play, because they allow children to learn how to negotiate the rules of life. And that learning includes, you know, breaking rules, exploring consequences. What would it be like if I was really big and bad and out of control? How far could I push these boundaries and limits? That's all completely normal. And it's really clear that she's not doing it in the real world. She is doing it in her imaginative narrative Small World. I think it's beautiful, rich stage 2 play. She's doing really well with it. She really doesn't need her parents to interject or script her play for her, so leave that be. And this whole stage of play is about exploring the world and people outside of us. You know, who's the same? Who's different? What would it be like if I was different? So pushing boundaries, testing limits, great, let her at it. And don't be worried about the preschool, because, you know, once she starts preschool, you'll start seeing a whole new set of themes coming in, mm-hmm. and the characters will have the names of her peers, and she might still play out these themes of good, bad, right and wrong. It's developmentally very appropriate. If anything, she's a little ahead of herself with those themes.
There you go. Your child's a genius. That's the best possible answer to get. We have a nearly four-year-old boy that we cannot get to sleep at night, and it's a nightmare. He sleeps in a room with his older sister, and he is stopping her from going asleep and waking her up too, so she's exhausted. He's a very happy, active, physical, boisterous little boy. At nighttime, we cannot get him to calm down and go to sleep. Anything I have read has said to have a calming bedtime routine, but it is impossible with this boy, as it's not just in his nature to be calm. We have tried stopping him from playing and making him sit and watch TV for a few minutes before bedtime so that he's not wired going down to the bedroom and then going to the bed and doing stories. But during story time, it's impossible to stop him from jumping around the room, doing cartwheels, punching, etc. I have to say, in the room until he falls asleep. Otherwise, he would be out of the bed jumping on his sister. But even with this, he's doing circles around the bed, talking, messing with his teddy, with me sitting beside him. Some evenings, it takes 2 hours to get him to relax and sleep. I'm ashamed to say I have flipped the lid a few times, taken his teddy away and thrown it in the bin. I tried to hold him down to stop him from climbing around the bed. This makes him upset and be quiet a little bit sometimes. But then as soon as they go out away from him or give teddy back, he starts laughing at me and gets back to the messing. I've also threatened that he won't get his Friday treat, but he doesn't care because it's not an immediate thing. I know this isn't the way to handle it, but I can't find any other way. We don't let him nap during the day, as this just makes him even worse. Can you suggest anything?
Oh gosh, I mean, I really feel for this parent, don't you? When you read this, you're just going, oh, everything is, you're trying and it's just not working. And I think that bit, you know, where you flip your lid and you take the teddy and you throw the teddy out and then you bring the teddy back, and all you're telling him is you're not consistent, that, you know, and in that moment, it's not about him and his behavior, it's about your frustration. And that's completely relatable, because bedtime has become stressful for all of you. Actually, all of you, not just him. So, you know, everything you're doing isn't going to work. I think as parents, you're going to have to tag each other in and out, because 2 hours is epic to be spending getting him to sleep. And you're going to get frustrated with that. So if one of you takes, you know, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, just tag each other in so that he's always getting a calm response, because neither of you are going to get so worked up that you flip your lid. I think that would be beneficial. The other thing is, you know, you're trying this calm routine, but you're trying it by having him sit and watch TV before bed. And actually, that's the exact opposite effect for little kids. It's actually stimulating. Even if it quietens him, just because he's quiet doesn't mean he's calm. He could be just completely absorbed in what he's watching. But that the stimulus of the screen, the TV, whatever it is actually activating him. And that's not going to help you. So you actually need to cut the screens. There should be no screens an hour before bed for children and young people. Also us adults, but let's just deal with the kids at the moment, you know, because that's going to be a friend. So instead, the few minutes before bedtime, as you're calling it there, have him play, sit and play with him, read books, do jigsaws, build blocks, do Legos, that kind of thing, because that is calming. It's very rhythmic. It's, you know, ritualistic, and it's using the fine motor skills. It's bringing his focus from broad into narrow, just at the task in hand. That's going to be much more effective. The other thing that jumped out at me is you've got an exciting little boy on your hands. Mm-hmm. And how much physical activity or physical playtime is he getting in his day? Just so you know, he would need at least 3 hours, that's minimum, in waves of mild, moderate, high level of activity. Okay, so it's not high activity all the time, but just waves of it. Lots of outdoor play, regardless of weather. You know, if you've got access to a garden, great. If not, if you can get him out for a walk or to some green space, open space, that would be amazing for him. The play before bed, as I said, you know, the books, the jigsaws, but also maybe I'm thinking a bit of match and regulate, do a bit of mirrors so that you're setting the tone, so that you would have him copy what you do. So in that, you might start with the physical, stamping your foot, wiggling your finger, shaking your head, patting your belly, doing wiggles all over your body, and then gradually bring your movements to something calmer, that you're just touching your nose, gently wiggling and waving your arm side to side,
doing big stretchy yawns up high as you can down to your toes, so that by the time you get to bed, you have wound him down. You are the one who's co-regulating and setting the tone and the temperature of the play. I think all of that would be good. When you get him into bed, keep it somewhat active. And what I mean by that is, it's not just get into bed and be quiet and I'll sit here while you're quiet, because he just can't do that. Some kids can, but this one can't. So when he gets into bed, sing him into bed. It doesn't matter what you sing, just whatever you're saying, put it into a song of some kind. It doesn't even have to be good or in tune, just sing it. Get him into bed, do the little book or story, whatever you're doing, and then a top to toe goodnight touch. So you're going to say goodnight to his head and kiss his head, his forehead, his eyes, his cheeks, his nose, his chin, all the way down to his toes, kiss his toes. So you've got a top to toe countdown, but it's also very sensory. And then you're going to sit with him however long it takes, tagging each other in and out if it's getting frustrating, until he has been lying still for 5 unbroken minutes. Because it's only if he can lie still for 5 unbroken minutes that he's remotely calm enough to go to sleep.
Right, okay. Somebody else suggests, try the Moshi app. It's M-O-S-H-I. It's meditation for kids. I have a complete looper 5-year-old and this works. I've been 2 years trying to get him to sleep. So, you know, maybe worth investigating that as
yeah.
well. Now, how do I stop my 3-year-old from eating crayons and mala? She loves playing with these things, being creative, and I encourage it. However, inevitably, all these things end up in her mouth. I've tried to say no, taking them from her, hiding them, not allowing colouring, but that's not a great long-term threat in reality. She must love the texture or something, but I'm worried her gut is lined with Play-Doh. How do I make her stop?
Oh, make her stop. Wouldn't we love to be able to make 3-year-olds just stop doing something they do? You can't. I mean, all you can really do is distract and redirect. Because if you do a whole, don't be eating the crayons, all she hears is eat crayons, because that's just what's on her mind. I think as well what you want to do, and I'm sure you are, but just in general, ensure the products are, where possible, homemade, you know, homemade Play-Doh instead of the shop bought stuff. And if it is shop bought, make sure that it is non-toxic. And, you know, I don't want to say edible. If it's homemade, it's edible, but at least make it non-toxic. I'm thinking things like make scented Play-Doh, because if I'm eating it to increase the sensory experience I'm having from the Play-Doh, then actually, if you you know, you can make it using cocoa powder and it'll smell like chocolate. You can make it using lemons or lavender or orange oil or anything, like from your herb cupboard, to throw a bit of basil or thyme into your Play-Doh and it will scent it. And that makes it that you're engaging that sense instead of the taste one with her. You could also do, you know, those sensory jars that you put the glitter in, things like that, and just make sure it's well sealed, because you've got a curious one on your hands, so that she can toss it and turn it around, and it'll all move and see all of that. There's lots of videos and YouTubes on how to do those things. And the other thing that came to my mind that she could eat, and you could actually make this part of the task with her, is make pastry sculptures. So just get your pastry, and the just roll kind is completely fine. You don't have to make that. A little egg cup of flour. Don't give a 3-year-old a bag of flour, but an egg cup of flour. Let her get rid of the cutters and shapers and just let her manipulate it with her hands, so that she can bend it, twist it, turn it, and make it into some kind of a shape that you can put into the oven, bake it, and then it can come to the table and look at, no matter how much it's been manhandled or on the floor, it won't kill anyone. Everybody could have a nibble. And it is something that you're building in part of this, the nurture of eating it. So I think that could be useful. In terms of the crayons specifically, though, I think at her age, she'd be able for them. Get the pencil crayons. You know, they're like a thick, like a chubby wooden pencil, but the nib of it is crayon-like. I think that would be much easier, because she's less likely to eat those, because they're not as, you know, coloured crayons are very inviting for children. They do look like sweets when you got them in a bag or a box. Mm. So I think the pencil option is something to look at.
Yeah, okay. I suppose they all stop doing it eventually.
Anyway. Oh, they do. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. And this is not pathological, apps, far from it. Like, this is very normal for little kids to do.
Yeah. But, you know, just for the time being, you're just going to have to keep saying, where did I put those crayons? Joanna, yeah. Thank you very much for talking with us today. Joanna Fortune there. We're going to take a break.
Moncrief on News Talk
with the Dacia Duster. Shockingly affordable. And now with 3 months deferred payments too.